Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with writer, producer, and actor Mindy Kaling. Here's a little trivia. Both Mindy Kaling and I were cartoonists for our college newspapers, but only one of us went to Dartmouth. Right, that was her. And only one of us has played the role of Ben Affleck to rave stage reviews. Oddly enough, that was her too. So I guess it probably follows that she's also the one that was hired as the only female writer on The Office at age 24, and was eventually made the boss of her own TV show, The Mindy Project. Ever since she started writing scripts on her mom's typewriter at age 6, Mindy planned to be a comedy writer. And she didn't mess around. After 8 hours of high school and 5 more of homework, it was time to study Conan and Saturday Night Live. In college, free time was spent in theaters with a notebook. Then she wrote a crazy play that got her a ticket to Hollywood and one of the best writing gigs around. She had it made, on paper anyway. In our talk, Mindy shared the ups, downs, and frequent loneliness of her early career. I think you'll be inspired by how she found her own voice and how she's used it to topple some of our longest-standing notions about comedy. If you confuse her with the characters she plays, you could get the impression she's a bit wild or maybe even superficial. It's an understandable mistake, but one you'll never make after this conversation. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hello, Mindy.
Hi, Sam.
How are you?
Really good.
You know, I met you in 2007, briefly.
Okay.
Because I was going to direct an episode of The Office, and I think it was season 3, and I went and I did like the table read, and I went to an edit session, and I hung out with Greg Daniels and shadowed him, and I met you. You were like super nice to me.
Oh, thank God.
You were so nice.
I was just waiting. I was like, and then you were so rude to me.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that I was
nice. You had me thrown off the lot. You were really nice. And then the writer's strike happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for like 9 months, the entire TV industry went away, right? It was like forever.
Yeah.
And sort of things got shuffled around. Then I never ended up doing it. And I always thought, like when I saw your episode on The Mindy Project, your sliding doors episode,
mm-hmm.
I thought, there's another life where you and I are really good friends.
Because we met through, or you tried to direct me and I was a monster.
Right.
So it could have been, it could have been good that we never met.
There's a sliding doors where I had to take out a restraining order on you.
Yeah.
No, but that was like almost 10 years ago. So I'm sorry for the 10 years that we didn't have together.
We could have had, we can make it up here.
Yeah, let's make it up here.
Yeah, the strike was so weird. I was just thinking about that.
Did you think that you might not have a job? Like, or that things would change so much that the show wouldn't come back?
No, you know, I think it was after season 2.
Right.
So we had done 24 episodes. And at that time, I think we just won the Emmy for best comedy. So I think if anything, we were like, at least for me, because I wrote and acted on that, I remember being like, ooh, a little break is my feeling. And at that time, NBC didn't have like a lot that was working. So they were like churn out episodes. So we had this, I thought the strike, I'm in this really strong minority here. I a little bit enjoyed the strike because for me, I was like, I'm in a union. I get to demand my rights. And like, I'd only been in the Writers Guild for a couple of years prior to that. But I do remember feeling like it was important. Though if you'd asked me exactly what the strike was about, I would have been like, I don't know. But
something regarding contracts and the internet.
And digital residuals.
Yeah.
In perpetuity or something very aggressively boring.
Well,
but important.
I think that, for people like me that did a lot of commercial directing and photography and everything at that time, it wasn't such a great thing because so much production just shut down.
Oh, no. I mean, to not make money for 8 months, 9 months was horrible.
Yeah.
And the effects of which, I mean, there's so many promising shows that got canceled during that time. And
so many promising directors.
So many promising directors that didn't.
Things.
Yes, yeah.
You and I have something in common. We both were cartoonists at our college paper.
Were you really?
I was at Gonzaga University, and I was the political cartoonist.
Okay, so that's very classy.
It wasn't that classy.
Well, the fact that it's political, the fact that you were in an undergraduate and were like, I have enough strong opinions about this that I can write something. I mean, I think that's cool.
Well, it was Reagan. It wasn't that hard to come up with stuff. It was just, I could draw him, and that was half the battle.
That's still huge. I couldn't draw at all. I was at Dartmouth, and there's so few people interested in comedy there, but they have spots for comic spaces in their newspaper. So my friend Jake, who's the editor-in-chief, was like, do you want to draw something? And I was like, I can't draw at all. And he's like, just like own it. So I did that for a couple of years.
Well, I looked at some strips, and what was amazing is even at that age, your voice is in there.
Really?
I think so, yeah. I guess I wonder if when you were in college, you were kind of searching for that, or if you were just trying to find any outlet for comedy at that time.
I think in high school, I remember discovering like Saturday Night Live and watching that on Comedy Central when they would just show like endless episodes on loop. And I remember thinking like, that is so great. And this is before you could record yourself on your phone or write sketches. So when I got to college, you know, we still, the idea of you can only be a TV writer by being a TV writer. You can't really practice it that much. This is back in like the mid 90s. You couldn't really do that. So when I was in college, you still couldn't, but I could do sketch comedy and I could write comedy for like, so I was just trying to find something. But I feel lucky that there is no taped material of me basically before the age of 24. Because when you're trying to do that and you're trying to figure out your voice, there's so many missteps and cringeworthy things. And like, I'm humiliated that you even looked at my old comic strips. But it's all valuable and it's good that it's out there. But God, these, I feel so, my heart goes out to young people because when they're, you know, putting up sketches on Vine or YouTube, it's, it, everyone can see it.
Yeah, and it's there forever. You're right. I mean, it's true. I think that missing a great portion of that in my life, too, growing up, you don't want to be accountable for everything. You do want to sort of workshop and woodshed in private and everything. But I think reading your books, because when I found out you were coming on the show, I went and read your books, and I really liked your writing, and I really felt like, and I was a little offended because in the book it says it's not for me. It's not for the straight man.
Yeah.
It's like if you're a gay man.
No, this is very surprising hearing that you own them even.
Or, yeah.
Did they think it was weird at the bookstore where they're like, you didn't mean to?
No, because I did electronic.
Got it.
So, and I think that what I took away from your style of writing is that you have this ability to sort of write as though you're writing to one person. You know what
That's
I mean?
That's so nice. Thank you.
Did you have a picture in your head of who you were writing to?
Truly, it's like I think I was trying to write to my smartest and funniest friend that I think very highly of. And I wasn't like writing down to someone. I was just trying to make them laugh and think I was cool, but in that way with someone that you are very close to. And I think the nicest compliment I get is that when people read my book, that they think that they're my best friend. It's something I hear the most frequently, and it's kind of the nicest compliments. But I like when people read the books because you can see how different I really am than the character I play on my show.
Right. Well, there's definitely an element of that where you get the sense reading the book that it's important for you to express those differences. Like I feel like the subtext of some of those chapters are that you're misunderstood quite a bit.
Huh.
Like people assume that you are your characters.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe more so than some guy on a show.
Definitely.
Right?
I definitely think that. Yeah.
And that must be weird because, I mean, to some extent, every artist probably feels misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
But does part of that come from the frustration of you can't control that? You can't control what someone takes in? You can only...
I think, especially when you are a show creator, I think I didn't help myself, but my character's name is Mindy as well, which was actually not my decision. It was the decision of the head of Fox at the time who thought it felt more immediate. And because I so badly wanted the show to be in the air, I was like, sure, she can have my same name. But she wasn't called Mindy at the beginning. And then what was her name? Her name was Mira, which I was like, oh, it's Indian, but it's also easy to pronounce and people, you know, it's close enough that it's not shocking to hear someone call me that. But he wanted the character to be called Mindy. And at the time, it was one of those things where if I really sit and think about this and what that will mean, I will not want to do it. But like TV, we were talking about this earlier, it's like you don't have that time to sit and think about it. You're just like, sure, whatever it's going to take to get it on there. And the ramifications of that are huge to allow a character that you play, that you write, be called your first name. It's a sort of a tacit endorsement of the idea that you're the same person. And so I don't get angry with people when they think I'm the same as the character. I'm just surprised because of how wild she is.
Right. And obviously there are extreme elements that, of course, but I can see that. Like you take Jerry Seinfeld as a classic example.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people sort of go, okay, it's based on his life. It's He's a comedian on the show. He's, like, it's easy for people to go, that's exactly who Jerry Seinfeld is. Mm-hmm.
But I think, and I think the difference is obviously that I think I'm, it's almost the opposite. Like, my character on the show is like, of course I want to play that character because she says the craziest stuff. She is incredibly uninhibited. The clothes she wears, I mean, just her whole lifestyle is so exciting. And I'm a like a boring comedy writer who goes home and watches like 6 hours of Narcos.
So you're living out this sort of crazy life through your character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe Jerry is too. So when you were sort of figuring out comedy, you know, when you were sitting at home going, what is the? Because I assume at one point it dawned on you that, oh, someone's writing the words that are coming out of people's mouths, right? Like, how old were you when you figured that out?
I was always writing, even as a kid. My mom was a doctor, and in one of her little rooms at her office, there's just a typewriter in there. This is like pre-computers when I was like 6 or 7, and I would have to come after school and work there. And I either could bring a book or sit and write on the typewriter, and that was more fun. So I was always, from a really young age, just like writing little like one-page plays and things. But in terms of... I think it was really that kind of quintessential time that most people get into comedy, which is like 12, 13, 14.
Yeah.
And I wasn't good at sports. I was good at school, but wasn't excited really by school yet. In high school, I got a little more interested. But I just love when I was sick and could go turn on Comedy Central and just watch like hours of stand-up and sketch shows and just soak it all in. I just
loved
it.
What was the show that really got you?
It's weirdly, there's a show called Dr. Katz Professional Therapist, which was an animated show that starred Jonathan Katz, the stand-up, and he's from Boston. And he would interview, the premise was that he was a therapist, he would interview stand-ups, and you'd have Sarah Silverman and Louis C.K., and this is early 90s, 92, 93. And I just loved the format of it. And even though I could never do stand-up, and I'm really terrified of it, I just sort of became enamored of that. And I sort of started being like, okay, what is this? And I'd research as much as I could about all the different stand-ups. And I read about like Emo Phillips and Carol Leifer and all these people that were really big.
Did you want to be a stand-up for a while?
I didn't want to be a stand-up, but I remember thinking, I like that each of them has like a really interesting, funny rant. Like they have a take on things, that they have fully formed, hilarious opinions. They have practiced in front of friends maybe,
right,
pacing in their house. And I just thought, I understood... That's when I kind of figured out like what the polish, like their polish, and just became really interested in that. Although I didn't want to actually be a stand-up. I was like, I want to write. And then Conan was huge for me.
Right.
When I was 14 and Conan O'Brien started, I was like, this is the expression of like who I am. The way I think some people felt about Letterman, like, you know, generation before,
yeah,
that his antics was like exactly what they were interested in. He was Conan's interview style and his sketch style was like expressing completely like what I thought was cool and funny.
Were you allowed to stay up that late to watch Conan?
I was, you know, because I was, at that point I was in high school and I was such a nerd that I was usually, I mean, like I'd go to school until like 6 at night, then do homework for 5 hours. Like I became like really hardcore. Like,
so you just never slept.
Yeah, I was just like a huge, like such a good little student. And so usually by the time I finished my homework, Conan was on and I'd watch like the tail end of the Tonight Show. And then that would come on, and I just, he was such a, like, rock star to me. And kind of still is. I mean, he's so amazing. But.
Yeah. Well, did your parents understand, like, that world at all, or did you express, like, this is what I want to do?
I think they didn't know the world at all, because we don't have that on either side of our family. But my parents loved comedy. They loved Seinfeld. They loved, like, Nichols and May. They loved listening to recordings of, like, you know, Jerry Seinfeld at Carnegie Hall on long family trips to, like, Virginia Beach or Niagara Falls when we were, like, in the car for 8 hours. They just really loved comedy. And watching Cheers and Seinfeld on Thursday nights was a huge part of our experience, like, shared experience as a family. Which is interesting because they're both immigrants, but they just loved it, too. I guess that's how, like, universally powerful they are. So I think they thought it was a cool thing for me to be interested in.
I mean, clearly you didn't go off to L.A. to try to be a stand-up or something. You went to a major literary school. You went to Dartmouth. And because of your upbringing and everything, did you have sort of a plan B, or did you think I could do other things, too?
Yeah, I always wanted to be a comedy writer. Once, like around 13, 14, when I knew that you could do that, that's what I wanted to do. And I knew that all through college. I think college was fun because I could perform in lots of different things, like in sketches, and I sang a little bit, but I always knew in the back of my mind, like, all I wanted to be doing was, like, just writing comedy. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't know that really New York is not the place. LA is the place. So I went to New York because it was kind of closer.
Right.
But yeah, and my little group of friends, they all sort of wanted to do performing as well, but none of them wanted to do exactly what I wanted to do. But we would put on, like, I had friends that were actors and musicians. So we'd put on little shows. I would write them. They would act in them. I would add music. And what was great about Dartmouth was there's literally nothing to do in Hanover, New Hampshire. So it gave me this really inflated sense of confidence that I got just because everyone was like, this is the only ticket in town. So we'd have these packed theaters
right.
to see these terrible little, like, you know, night of one act plays or sketch shows or whatever of these half-baked ideas and music that we had just, you know, written the day before. But there was nothing else to do in Hanover except for drink and go sledding, which you could only do so much. So it was great. I felt like Cher. It's like a best.
Well, how did you teach yourself? Like, did you start, like, watching with the idea of I'm going to break this down?
Yeah, it's like obsessive mimicry, I think, when you're a teenager, the kind of, where I always felt like it was so funny because I couldn't focus on anything as much as I could focus on comedy.
Really?
Like, well, yeah, and I was like any young person where, like, I would think even, like, you know, 90-minute college classes were, like, so tedious for me and everything, but I could sit and write down, like, every line of A Fish Called Wanda or something like that, a movie that I loved, and just sort of study it. And again, this is like the sort of the late 90s before all these, you have access to like every script. You can get the script of The Apartment online and you can just read it and study it. So I have all these memories of just like taking a notebook into movie theaters and just like writing down great lines I loved or notions I would have. But yeah, the reason I learned it, because I didn't take any TV writing classes at Dartmouth. I don't even think they offer them. It was just by like watching with like a real obsessive eye.
So you would write down in the theater lines that you liked and like
turns
go figure
of phrases
out like,
or setups that
how
I liked.
How the setup
or,
worked.
Yeah, or callbacks. Like the idea right. is like, oh, you know, like this is great in The Apartment where they call back that line that they said earlier, but I didn't like know that that's what it was called. So I just sort of was educated by massive consumption of things. The way that, like, you know when you're 19 and you can watch, like, 5 movies
yes.
in a day?
Yes.
And it's normal? Whereas now if you did that, you'd be like, oh, that's, like, a depressed person with, like, serious problems. Like, who can stay in one room and put, like, VHS tape after VHS
right.
tape? And I would watch, like, I'd sit in my room, just, like, eat pizza in my little Dartmouth dorm room, and I would just pop in VHS tapes, like, Woody Allen tapes that I'd, like, sent away for. Because I just wanted to see what they were all like, and you know, and I kind of learned more from the ones that weren't popular than I did from like the most popular ones.
It reminds me of someone like getting a computer and then taking it apart to find out how it works. Like,
mm-hmm.
did you try to figure out like why comedy worked on you, or like at that time were you going that's funny to me and that's not, and trying to figure out why?
Yeah, or like I would look at something and I would know how it was widely regarded, and then I'd watch it and go, I wonder why this isn't working. And I remember thinking, that's when I really learned a lot about like relatability
uh-huh.
and why in Annie Hall, even though those characters, like, you know, they're all like extremely wealthy, the movie isn't really about how they really are. You feel like, oh, I'm like Annie Hall. She doesn't have a lot of money. She lives like in a little apartment. And then some of the ones that he's like, everyone says I love you, is
yeah.
like they live in this like 4 floors of a townhouse in the Upper East Side, and how you're like a little bit detached from it because you're like, oh, I don't have a ballroom at my house. And I started learning like, oh, that's because in one movie, like Woody Allen has put up a little wall, which is his like insane wealth. It's relatable to him, but not to me. And so I'd be like, that's really fascinating. I don't know. So I would just like learn little tricks and write them down and try to apply it to my own writing.
So at what point did you say, okay, I'm going to write like a real project start to finish? And like, did you write a spec script or did you write?
No, I mean, the next thing is like, well, what do I have to say? Right.
Well, right? That's the voice part, right?
Right. Like, you just can't just like decide you want to, you know, because that's the worst thing you've ever seen, which is just like a fifth-rate Conan O'Brien, a fifth-rate Woody Allen, you know. And I feel, even though I probably never like articulated this to myself, that I really want whatever I have to say to be different.
Yeah.
And so for a while, it was like, around that time, it was like, what you're supposed to do is write spec scripts. So when I was 22, I think I wrote a spec script of Arrested Development. And I love that show, and it was great. But even then, I was like, oh, wouldn't it be like, wouldn't I stick out more, like, if I wrote something that was like a little bit weirder and offbeat? And from just, I did this play in New York City called Matt and Ben.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about that.
Which was extremely offbeat and
weird. We should say it was you and your friend.
My friend Brenda.
Your friend Brenda and
I played Ben Affleck, and my friend Brenda played Matt Damon in a really absurd, 50-minute, like not even an hour-long play.
Right, where Good Will Hunting, the script falls from his ceiling.
A script falls from the sky, from the ceiling.
Right, yeah. And it's sort of that moment where you get to see these two figuring out what to do with this gift they've been given from the creative gods. Tell me if I got this right, but it started out with the two of you just doing Matt and Ben impressions to each other to amuse each other, right?
Just like what we thought, like the media was so fixated on them in a way that was almost like they were a famous married couple. Like, that was just sort of what you were told was what you were supposed to be obsessed with.
Right.
And we just thought, like, these are actual friends. Like, they actually grew up together. They weren't like, you know, they didn't like meet each other at 24 and decide to like become famous by like pretending to be friends. And we thought, what a funny thing to have gone through as a pair of friends. And we were two sort of unfamous old friends. And we just thought we kind of made up personalities for the two of them based on just kind of what we thought would be funny as a flight of fancy. And I mean, that's one thing I really liked about my friend Brenda was these were not like attractive, like for two women to play. Like, these were not like, they weren't like cute characters. Like, we were playing guys.
Right.
And it wasn't like a thing you could see and be like, oh, she's like hot or she's pretty or something. It was just hard comedy. And later, now looking back on it, I think like, wow, most girls that age who are trying to like break into TV and like they don't put on tracksuits and tie their hair up, wear no makeup, and wear baseball caps, and play guys with like, you know, I was in this play, I'm like manspreading the entire time and not wearing any makeup, and it was such a fun. It was completely unflattering, but the way we looked really unflattering, but just such a fun, real thing that just nobody was doing or understood, and was like, at a certain point, kind of was like, not really about those two guys at all, but just became this whole like, hey, like, come with us. We're in a 99-seat theater in the East Village. Like, just suspend your disbelief. And the fact that it worked was like such a fun little triumph, like downtown theater and like absurdity and stuff. And
what's fascinating to me, though, is the way it grew organically out of your friendship. Like, and I wondered if that process, the way you guys started doing the voices and doing it back and forth to each other, if that became part of your writing process, that because it worked the first time.
I have not until this moment thought of that, but I think you're really right. Like, if that whole play, I mean, it was also incredibly interesting to us as two best friends who were both trying to be writer performers.
Right.
And we would do it in New York downtown, which was just full of people trying to do the very same thing. But the talking to each other and just saying, writing down what we would say, which made the other one laugh. First of all, it's a really strange way to write because you are both performing, but then also being an editor at the same time. But it was great when we would do it together because we had such a shorthand that she could say, that was great, and write down what I had said, and vice versa. And then after a while, we'd be like, you know, it'd be fun to put these characters in a situation as this situation. And we'd be like, let's just try it. So the two of us would sit, and, you know, it would be, you know, Matt and Ben, Kevin come back from the gym, and one of them was like outran the other by whatever amount, and like how the two characters would feel with that, and how they would try to protect their egos and whatnot. So it was just like so much fun in the kind of way that you can only do when you don't have a job and you're like 21 right. years old and can sit and like fuck around for like 4 hours pretending to be these two famous men.
Yeah, but at some point, I'm sure one of you must have said, we should do this publicly, right? At some point,
it became, before we decided we would do it publicly, we were like, let's see, can we write this down? Maybe they're not Matt and Ben anymore. Maybe they're just two people.
Right.
Like in a play. And so we would write down, because the characters became so specific every time we would improvise them. And it's like, well, maybe we can just do something with two characters. We'll change their names, and this is just their dynamic. But what we realized was it was the most fun with them because you sort of, while you're picturing, like, for instance, my friend Brenda acting it as a woman, you, the specter of Matt Damon was always around,
right,
which was just really enjoyable. And with me, if you think of me, I'm 5'4", and I'm an Indian woman, it's like knowing that I'm playing Ben Affleck the entire time, when people would see it, was like, they're like, I can't explain it. You look nothing like him. You're not doing an impression of him, like a Saturday Night Live impression. It's just like you're embodying him in a way that is just thinking about him and the other side of your brain while you're watching this. It's just fun. And so we just were like, oh, let's just keep it. And, like, to be honest, like, if it had been two women, it would have felt mean-spirited.
Right. Plus, the whole audience has their own version of this story in their head of Matt and Ben.
Right. And we just thought, like, it's just felt like weird and funny. But it was strange how popular it was. And my God, it was so fun to do. It was so fun to act.
Well, what's interesting is that most people, if they want to be writer performers, I would assume they would start doing improv or they'd do stand up at the places where Saturday Night Live talent scouts occasionally mm-hmm. go and look and watch, and maybe not sit down and write their own avant-garde play. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Well, the truth was that we were trying to go to all those cool places, but they were not that welcoming. I mean, the atmosphere is very different then. I mean, 2001 to 2004, I didn't think you had the same feeling about embracing even the little comedy theaters and things, about embracing like a Indian woman into the comedy world. Like when I would go to different comedy theaters, improv theaters downtown New York, it was all white.
Right.
And now, even when I was at the office and the office had run for a couple of years, it had even gotten so much better. But we tried. It just, there was not, I remember we submitted the play to a really popular comedy theater in New York, and they didn't even respond to it. We were like, we like to put it up, and we never even got like a response back from them, even telling us that it was like rejected.
Really?
Yeah. No, I mean, completely, for years, just, and it's like a funny play. I don't even know if they read it.
That's so funny because, you know, you think about that time and like you said, not having a job and sitting around and doing this, mm-hmm. it must have been like a perfect recipe for pure art, though, because you're not thinking, we're going to put this on and we're going to get pilot offers. You couldn't think that way, right?
No, we didn't. And luckily for us, we didn't even know that that was the path, you know, that someone could come and give you like a pilot from it. We did think, we knew, you know, as entrepreneurial young people, that like this would get attention and maybe that could lead to, I don't know, maybe Brenda would get hired in some funny play and I could find out how you would even know someone who you could write a packet to write for SNL, you know, like, or something like
right.
that. But we didn't know enough to strategize so completely.
Right.
Yeah, so it was good.
So you did get a pilot offer mm-hmm. from Matt and Ben.
Yeah.
And what happened?
So when we first came out to LA, we were doing that play. And from doing the show here for a couple of months, I got two opportunities. The first was to do a show based on our lives, me and Brenda's and my life in it, and do like an autobiographical play, a TV show called Mindy and Brenda. And what they wanted was like two broke girls, I think,
right.
which are not like our skill set at all. But in the second job opportunity that came is Greg Daniels saw the play and hired me to be a writer on The Office.
So you already hired on that?
The pilot came first. So if the pilot had gone, I would have had to quit working on The Office. So while I was working, while I started writing on The Office, I was also working on a pilot with my friend Brenda. And then the pilot got shot with two other actresses.
Playing you guys?
Playing two characters named Mindy and Brenda.
So how did they give you that news?
In like the worst, most drawn out way. I mean, I can look back on it and consider myself lucky that at 24, I had like one of the most traumatizing experiences you could have as a writer performer in LA, which is that you create something for yourself to star in and named after you, and you audition for it and are not cast in that role.
You audition for yourself and they're like, sorry, we think we can find a better Mindy.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think they probably did. I mean, you know, when you don't know the pilot process at all and you're working on
right.
a pilot, I think we'd never done it before. We'd never written a pilot before. And I don't think it's that good. I think it's like, you have your voice. So what made Matt and Ben funny and good was that it was just like our undiluted voice. Now, you could never put that on TV because it was like 15 minutes long and weird and whatever. But it was really authentic and super funny. And when you're doing a pilot for the WB, which is a network that's no longer on the air,
yeah,
whose entire lineup, weekly lineup, is just good-looking soap opera actors playing vampires.
Right.
Like, we didn't understand, like, why they wouldn't want, like, our, like, Lower East Side sensibility to
you,
the show.
You thought you could take that intact and put it on the WB.
And put it on there and just say, like, okay, well, we're not playing these two crazy characters anymore, but certainly if they came to our show and liked our show, they want that sensibility.
Right.
And they don't. Now, I look now at, like, something like Broad City, which is just so them, and I'm like, oh, man, like, we would have been so excited to watch that show.
Yeah.
But that didn't exist in 2004.
Right.
And at least we would have been so lucky had that been on, because A, we would have loved it, and I love that show, but also because it was not, you know, two girls trying to, like, start a cupcake company.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, like, we didn't want it to be multicam, and they kind of forced us to make it a multicam comedy, and all these things that we were like, we'll do whatever to just get our show on the air. And then when we weren't cast in it, I think we were like, oh, okay, as much as this is a huge blow to our ego, and it was, I mean, it was also like, well, this bears so little resemblance to what we wanted to do that it's not that terrible.
But you gotta think that it's just amazing that you would write your first play, have it not only kill in New York, but also travel,
mm-hmm,
and then get an opportunity to write on The Office and get your own pilot. Like, it's kind of amazing that you just sort of made your own success very quickly.
When you say it like that, it makes me, I'm like, whoa, I'm cool as hell. That
yeah,
sounds really cool.
You
but
are.
There's so much heartache at that time, because I remember, it's like, it's so nice thinking back on it, but like the experience of the pilot was, I have like mental scars forever. I mean, like, I think later I was part of the reason I was happy to play a character named Mindy on my show was like, see, like, fuck you, I finally can play a character named Mindy, like, that I create.
I am good enough to be me.
And the other thing was, on The Office, that first season, like, everybody hated it, and everyone was so hard on it. So it was like this year and a half of like, oh, everything I'm doing is just like not working out. Like,
so it felt like you were failing.
As much as I was feeling accepted, I mean, I was making like $500 a week doing that play in New York City, but I felt like, I owned the city because of how well received it was, and I didn't really have any expenses anyway, so it was fine. And then to come and do this stuff, which on paper everyone's like, whoa, pilot, you're working on a network show, and then both are, one is, rejects you, your own bad pilot rejects you, and then The Office, which I thought was brilliant and great, like, people were just pummeling. Luckily, our second season, things turned around, but I remember being like, I hope I don't have to move home.
So you thought that, like, you could have had your shot and blown it. Like, that's how it felt.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I mean, we did 6 episodes of the first season, so I couldn't even say that I had done, like, 13 episodes of a show. I could prove that I was, like, a comedy writer even, you know, to go staff on another show or something.
But you're also in this totally new environment. Like, talk about your relationship at the beginning with Greg Daniels, mm-hmm, and how long it took you to sort of get on solid ground or equal ground where you didn't feel like... Like, because you must have been nervous at the start.
Oh,
right?
And I'm still nervous around Greg, because, I mean, he's a genius. So I still, and he's, not only is he a genius, he's, and he might say he's neurotic. He does not project neuroses. He's very easy with, like, a long pause. He's very thoughtful, and in the middle of him making a point, he's fine taking, like, 15 to 20 seconds to make sure that it's exactly worded the right way. Whereas I'm the opposite. I'm like, I don't want to, like, I feel like I'm always like tap dancing and speaking really quickly and things. But the first season was incredibly exciting because I was so impressed by the talent of the other writers. It was Mike Schur and BJ Novak and Paul Lieberstein and Greg Daniels. But I was also, and I think that they would be okay with me meaning this, they're not the friendliest guys at all. And they had, like, 4 of them had gone to Harvard and was on the Lampoon. And I was the youngest, and I was the staff writer that
right.
came from New York that had no TV experience. And I remember this so well. I remember Mike Schur, who is now a great friend, has created so many awesome shows and everything, invited BJ to a Dodgers game. It was like a Red Sox Dodgers game, like in the writer's room of like six people. And I remember feeling like so left out and being like, oh, so this is the old boys club that they always tell you about.
Right.
And I'm witnessing it. It was very exciting, but I was also like friendless and living in a terrible apartment on Fountain that cost like $800 a month. It was covered in mold.
But that could be a lonely time, right?
So lonely. I remember being terrified and silent for most of the first season.
Oh, really?
But if you ask any of those guys, they were like, you were not terrified and silent at all. You were expressing your opinions loudly, constantly. So I guess there's what you feel, and then there's like how you express it. But yeah, I thought I was like very demure and not saying anything, but no one else seems to think I was.
When you found your stride, did you lose some of that terror? Did it turn into, oh, I belong here? And
well, I mean, if you ask any comedy writer, I think, on a show like that, because I was there for 8 years, I felt like job security, like I was not going to probably get fired unless I did something horrible. But also, it was incredibly competitive because everyone had their ambitions within the show, you know,
right.
Get more screen time, get, you know, a ton of scripts, direct. But then everyone had their ambitions outside of the show. So after 4 seasons, I was like, well, I'm working really hard. And all of a sudden you see like, oh, Mike's creating Parks and Recreations. And you're like, wait a second, am I supposed to be more ambitious than just this?
Right.
You know, am I supposed to be thinking more than just like coming here at 6 a.m., acting, you know, writing, leaving at 10 o'clock every single night?
Which sounds like enough.
It sounds like enough.
Yeah.
And then you start feeling, and I was content being like, oh, I should be doing that. Or, and so that's sort of, I felt like why, in some ways, I started getting interested in writing my books and thinking there's this world of The Office, which is so funny with so many funny characters, is still pretty different than like what my natural voice is.
Right.
And I've been trained in this, you know, to write a mockumentary for 8 years is like you get really trained in one specific like trade. I was like a tradesman now in how to write mockumentary. But I thought, it's been a long time since I've just written like I think this, I think that, and I'm a kind of like overtly girly, like traditionally kind of girly woman that, you know, loves New York City, and I love like fashion and romance and romantic comedies, and I'm working on a show that is a romantic comedy, but it's like a mockumentary in Scranton where what's beautiful is like the plain and unadorned.
Yeah.
And I'm not that.
Right.
And so my show is a real reaction to that in a lot of ways, but also my book, it was, I think, so different than the tone of The Office.
What was the reason to sit down and write them?
Well, there was just so much left on the table after I would finish a week of shooting and working on The Office, which in many ways, I mean, I don't think everyone thinks this, but I think that show is pretty masculine. You know, like Steve was the star, it was like Michael Scott and Dwight, and the paper company and like everyone. I just felt like, you know, with the exception of Pam and obviously my character, but like it was just I thought it was a very funny workplace show that had a really male streak to it.
Right.
And I loved working for that show. I wrote like 25 episodes of the show, and I still think now, like, what would Michael Scott do? How would he talk about like Uber or Brexit or like all of
right,
that stuff?
Right.
Like, he's just such a funny character. And I think like a classic TV character, but I thought, there's so much else that I love and want to write about. And some of it was like romantic comedy in New York City. Frankly, I still felt homesick for New York, even 8 years into living here and having like what some would argue was the best comedy writing job in TV.
Yeah.
Also, I think it's weird because I got a Twitter account in like 2008. And I remember thinking, okay, well this, I don't really have time to do focus a lot of energy on this. And I still feel that way about it. But the feedback I would get for just things that I would say or think about during the day, the amount of positive feedback and the way that people were treating it, responding to it, was so surprising to me that I was like, well, if people want to hear like these little tiny like fragments of what my life is like or what my point of view is like, they might be interested in more, like essays.
Right.
And so the confidence to write the first book of essays really came from people's reaction to my Twitter account. You know, because like, when you're like number 12 on the call sheet at The Office and like you're a writer, it's a big deal, you know, when I was like 28 to be like, wow, Entertainment Weekly said I was a Twitter account to follow. You know, like you
right.
feel, because it's like not something where like if the people compliment The Office, it's like I can't take the credit for The Office, right? I think I'm helpful to it, but it's not like mine. And so when people would compliment my Twitter, I'd be like, Mom, look, someone said my Twitter account was cool. It was like all me, I felt.
Right, right.
And so I thought that feeling got really addictive, you know, and I was like, oh, I want to do more that's just me and my voice.
I think one thing that social media did that was positive, if we could find one thing that's positive, is that it did sort of validate people's own voices.
Yeah.
Like, you can instantly get feedback that I can totally be myself and people respond and I connect with people, right?
Absolutely, and it gives you, you know, you see people who are parts of things like different shows or maybe they're athletes or maybe they're news anchors or whatever, and you get to see a window and we know, especially if you're in the business, how much of it is artifice and just like writing for people. And when you see someone who's like authentically funny and they have something like that, it feels exciting, even for me. So Twitter was weirdly very confidence-giving for me to help develop my own voice.
So as The Office went on and other people are working on other shows and you know it's the end is coming, you made a deal to develop your own show, like within your contract, right?
Within my contract. So for Universal, right, to write a show.
So I want to talk about this because it's interesting that you chose to portray an OBGYN on The Mindy Project, and that's what your mom did.
Yeah.
And I was curious about the timing of that, like, because I would imagine when you think about, okay, now I'm, you know, I've written for The Office for 8 seasons, I can make any show I want. I can, like, you can conceive any show you want, do anything you want. What made you decide, like, ultimately that the best place for your next project was going to be set in the world of an OBGYN living, you know, in New York? And
well, I think I had had a sort of, I felt I had seen a lot in movies, bad movies, a lot of like girl who works at the magazine or girl who works at the bakery, you know, like, and I thought it felt, as like a cynical comedy writer, it just felt like those are just so expected. It's sort of like girly in a way that's like not like funny, like hard joke funny. And I thought there's something great. One of my favorite performances in any TV show is Hugh Laurie in House.
Yeah.
Because he's such a dick, but he has so many problems, and he has like he's an addict too. And like what's so great about him is he's a doctor. And he's helping people. So he has this very economical way of redeeming his character every episode because he's being really mean and then at the end he's like helping a little girl, you know, with some horrible medical problem. And I thought, that is a good trick because I don't want to play because so many of the lead female characters in like the early 90s on these shows are just the blah straight man woman.
Right.
Who is there to dissuade the guys from going on the road trip or having the bad idea.
And she's nice
sensible and nice.
Yeah.
I mean, think of how far things have changed between like now. Like now it's like there's Veep and Amy Schumer and Girls and all these and Broad City and all these other shows.
Right.
I mean, but this was like a desert for female leads in shows. And I was like, oh, no. I love Basil Fawlty. I love Steve Carell and as Michael Scott. I am not doing that trick.
Yeah.
Or like, I'm not writing myself the best part. And so I thought I'd make her a doctor because then I could do more stuff. And it's worked as a trick. It really does.
Well, you're in your 5th season. But were you able to sort of bounce it off your mom as you were conceived? You know, I mean, obviously, it's not like you're going to her to say, how do I do this? But,
you know, so my mom passed away before I wrote the pilot. And so I was still thinking about it and working on it.
Oh.
But she'd passed away right around that time. And I remember thinking, and very clearly, is I loved growing up with an OBGYN means that you've kind of done through your whole life just like a lot of like research on it just by living with one. And for me then, because it was such a tough time to have to work on this pilot while my mom was sick, but I remember thinking like, why am I making this harder for myself? You know, like, because at that time when I was working on the pilot, I'd actually moved back home to be with my mom when she was sick. And I thought like, you know what? I don't want to like have to research like what an art gallery or whatever these jobs are that, you know, these random jobs I'm not interested in. I know what an OBGYN's lifestyle is like. I lived with her. I know the hours. And I think it's cool. I think it's like kind of a noble job.
Yeah. You're delivering babies.
You're delivering babies. It's super exciting. And so I just kind of pulled the trigger on it, and I was like, okay, that's what her job is. And then I knew how to write a workplace show in the office. So I just kind of just like Frankensteined all these like things that I knew about into something that felt like I could write about it a lot.
Did it feel like a tribute to your mom at all?
It's such a good question. I think my mom would have thought she's so different than that character, but I think she would have liked a lot of the observations about that lifestyle a lot. And she would have really liked, I think my tribute to my mom will probably be like a movie or a book I write about her, because she was such a fascinating person and a really serious person with an incredibly funny streak. I mean, she was such a well-regarded doctor in the Boston area, and her patients loved her. But I think she would have thought the show was funny and like frivolous, and she would have like liked my outfits. But I think the tribute to my mom will probably be something else.
Well, you know what I love that you said about it was that, you know, you said that it's called the Mindy Project. It's not called the Indian Girl Project. Mm-hmm. And I think that your legacy can partially be that you didn't feel like you had to create a show where you come to Manhattan and the show is about you learning how to fit in. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And it shows how far television has come. And I think that to make a mainstream comedy that works across ages and, you know, the sexes and everything, that I would think would be the thing that your parents would be the most proud of, was that you managed to make a comedy that works for everybody. You know what I mean? That mm-hmm. doesn't have to play to some idea of what you're supposed to be.
That's such a nice thing to say. And I think I definitely think my parents would have liked that. It's tough. I think it's a little sad. I think now that as much as there has been a lot of progress, particularly for women on TV shows and even within that and on comedy TV shows, it's as a minority, as a dark-skinned minority person, more often than not, in order to get a show on the air, it has to be like what your overt deal is. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're a minority, it has to be about like the minority going through that situation. And I don't know, like, I think there's more than, you know, people are obsessed with your otherness, even if you aren't, you know, and I think trying to balance that while not like denying what my roots are, I also don't want to rely on it for all the source of all my inspiration.
Is it like when you get into it and you start like almost getting to this point reveals how much more that there is to go, right?
Yeah, I think like very slowly but surely, like those things are changing in that regard too.
Yeah. Also, it must be for you, it must be, you know, to go from, like you said, number 12 on the call sheet in the office mm-hmm. to number one. I mean, you probably saw yourself more as a writer on The Office, right, than a performer. Mm-hmm. And now I'm sure, like I watched middle of season 4, like there's some heavy dramatic acting going on. Like you've definitely crossed over into some territory that we could go for hours about the marriage plot and flipping that script and, mm-hmm. and what you've done on your show. But I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about maybe the personal growth that you've made through this show as an actor,
and
that part sometimes gets sort of undermined by the story that we're talking about. There, the topics of race and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I knew, especially when the show moved to Hulu, where we did not have the same pressure to be like, hey, make sure the show's cheerful all the time because we're going to be throwing to a Dove commercial and like people need to want to buy soap.
Right.
We can't like bum people out about like how a marriage isn't working or that two people who are in love but extremely different can clash, which is a lot about what season 4 was.
Yeah.
And what was so good about coming to Hulu is that we were like, okay, well, guess what? Like, we get to show the realities of what it's like when, you know, two people who are very attracted to each other and are very good for each other in a lot of ways are together.
Yeah.
And they have a kid and what comes up when that happens. And the great thing is I was acting with Chris Messina, who is like one of the best actors in the world. I mean, he's just he just has made me such a better actor just by acting with him. You know, he just like raised the bar. And I think being able to do that was great because I think a lot of times I've been in TV for 10 years and I was like, well, don't I have control over this show? Now we're on Hulu. We can do whatever we want. The episodes can be as long as we want them to be. I want to taste what it'd be like if we were shooting like a movie. And sometimes in a movie, there's parts where people are really upset and crying and dealing with hard things and saying harsh things to each other. And we can let it breathe because we're not on a network anymore. And we can throw it to a commercial and it doesn't have to be cheerful. And that was such a rewarding experience for me as a writer, and certainly as an actor. But to be able to write myself that stuff, write him that stuff, it really like unlocked me in a lot of ways and made me be like, wow, okay, well, now I have, now I want to do this more.
I feel like you've taken some chances with it that mm-hmm. makes it way more interesting than maybe even the original expectations for it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I think you can never give the lead everything that she wants, because then, like, who would want to watch that? I want to watch, like, strivers and people who are just always looking for... And if this is a girl who just wants to be skinny, married to, like, a rich man, and have, like, you know, three children and be a millionaire, it's like, and also dress in great clothes. It's like, well, you can only give her, like, two of those things. Like, life is hard for everybody. And I think... life is hard. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have to be funny. And if most people live their daily lives every day being like, I enjoy my life, I think it's good, but it is really fucking hard, I think that that's an okay thing to show in a comedy show. Even when the girl is wearing, like, you know, incredible clothes and haute couture and has a great job and lives in a great apartment, like, it's, I think that we like to see that reflected. We like to see people go through trials, you know, and it can be super funny along the way, but I think then you root for the character. So
yeah.
It's just kind of a nice tool to just use.
Well, listen, your story and the way you created your own path is really inspiring to me. And I think that anyone who's endeavoring any creative career could look at what you did and say, she did not wait for someone to give her an opportunity. She made her own opportunity. And I think... those are my favorite kind of artists to talk to, because when you make your own opportunity, you can't help but be original. And what you've done, the books you've written, the shows you've created, they're inspiring, not just to women, but to anyone who wants to have an original, creative life.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so thanks for sharing this stuff with me, and also for, you know, for your writing. And I think one of the things I want to close on is that you love your parents, and you didn't have to stray so far and rebel and go crazy. And, like, you have this moral code, I think, that has served you well in this very alternative world of comedy. And mm-hmm. I don't know, it's just, your story's impressive.
That's so nice of you, because I have met a lot of comedians, I've been interviewed by a lot of comedians, where there's this outdated viewpoint of this feeling that you have to be desperately unhappy and have had a bad relationship with your family or everyone around you growing up, and to be funny. And if you don't do that, if you don't express that in your art, or if you didn't experience that and like want to luxuriate in that, that you're somehow not like legit or the real deal. And I love just like breaking that notion, because it's outdated. And it's like kind of, yeah. I think it's like a residual like from 80s, early 90s road comic mentality. And to be perfectly honest, I think it's very white and male. And I think that if you are the child of immigrants...
The white male angst.
The white male angst. And if
I'm
you don't have it...
I'm not going to take any offense.
And, if you, and I'm going to say this with love, because so many of my closest friends and comrades and colleagues are white men. But I think it's like... I see it, and there's like... it's still around, and I still see it. But I just love that there's this new type of comedian that's out there that is completely not this older stereotype.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Yeah. It's okay to like your parents. It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay to like your parents. It's okay to not be on a million, you know, million prescription painkillers.
Or recreational drugs. Yeah, it's cool.
How boring.
How boring. You're never going to use this interview.
I am. It's too boring. Yeah.
It wasn't edgy enough.
Come back when you're high.
Okay.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was so much fun.
And for sharing. I appreciate it.
Me too. So much fun.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor Kate Beckinsale.
I'd never thought about a public persona. I wasn't interested in it. I wasn't managing it. But I think when you run around for a couple of movies in skin tight rubber trousers, there's going to be a kind of an assumption. And I just thought I was immune to that. I can dress up like a bimbo for Halloween, but I'm not actually a bimbo, and I've not lived that life. It's just like a joke.
Kate's childhood came with a famous family and tragic loss. Both had a lasting impact on her life and her career. I ask her about choosing to study Russian versus drama school, why her first film was both her best and worst acting experience, and the shocks that came with making movies in the U.S. You'll never see her, or a fruit bowl, in the same way again. See you next time, off camera.